All right, everybody, welcome. It's so great to be here with you today for this edition of The Cosmic Connection. Today's subject is astrology a spiritual practice? So this is a little bit of a dovetail off of last week, but we're going to go into a lot of new territory. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Amanda Poole Walsh. I'm the founder of Astrology Hub, and I am here with Rick Merlin Levine. Thank you so much for being here with us, Rick. It's so great to be here every single week. It makes me so happy.
Yay. Well, it's like a metronome.
Yes.
You know, you and I and everyone else here probably has many things that they do in their life. But you know, Thursday afternoon, tick. Next Thursday afternoon, talk. Tick, talk. And it's like the metronome that was on my piano when I was a kid learning piano. It's as long as you played along with that, with those beats, it almost mattered less what you were playing as long as you hit the beat. So here we are hitting the beat.
It's so true. And it definitely is relevant for our topic today because it's the new moon. Mm-hmm. And the moon cycle offers a very similar kind of metronome energy for us. And especially when you work with it for different kinds of rituals and things. So,
yeah, no, absolutely. And I didn't even have that in mind when I said it, except it's obviously, it is what we're talking about today, or at least our entry into what we're talking about today, because you said something very interesting. You said it is a new moon. And the Virgo in me, not that I have any planets in Virgo, just to be clear, but we don't need to have planets in a sign to have that energy in us. The Virgo in me said, no, it's not a new moon. The new moon was at 4 a.m. Pacific time. That was like, that was like 12 hours ago.
Right.
You know, and this is really a very key point and interesting point because the new moon and the full moon, which are technically lunations. The word lunation originally just meant the new moon. It was the lunar tick-tock. It was the beginning of each cycle. But most astrologers use the word lunation to talk about either a sun-moon opposition or conjunction, meaning a full moon or a new moon. So the tick-tock of that lunar rhythm, which incidentally you can measure with any planet. It's just that those metronomes become so slow. We've just had a Saturn-Pluto conjunction back in the beginning or middle of January of this year. And that's a 35 to 38 year tick-tock. And then coming up in December, we have a Jupiter lining up with Saturn. That's a 20-year tick-tock every 20 years. And that's exact only on one day. Like the new moon is exact at 4 a.m. on September 17th in Seattle. That would be 7 a.m. in New York and what, 1 a.m. Where you are with 3 hours difference to Hawaii. So the thing, though, is that the universe or the cosmos is a lot more forgiving than our Virgo and piano tuner. Another thing I remember as a kid was the big day of having the piano tuner come. And my dad was a bit of an electronics geek, and he would tune the piano occasionally, and he had these devices that would get the exact notes and whatever, but it never sounded as good as when the piano tuner came, because they just know how to work the nuances. And the thing is that if you just go by the exact frequencies, sometimes that's not as integrated as the slight nuances that a human might add to adjust for how everything flows together. So here's where that kind of corresponds then with the new moon. The new moon was, at least where I live, at 4 in the morning. Now, does that mean that you get up at 3:45 a.m. so you can do your new moon ritual at the moment of the new moon? Or can you do it at night before you go to bed, catching the dark of the moon? Or can you do it the following day? And this is an interesting question, and my views on this have changed over the years by because of both observation and listening to other people's input, listening to what other people have to say about this. And there was a time when I believed that if you were going to do a ritual, if you were going to work with the energy of that new moon, the moment to plant the seed, the moment to do it was at the new moon. And it may turn out, it turns out that that may be a rather ineffective time, because at that exact moment of the sun-moon conjunction, that's kind of like a void. That's like an empty moment. And most of my friends who do a lot of planetary magic, which is really what, you know, in a larger context, this might be called magic. We might refer to it as doing a ritual, but in some ways it's using the energy of the cosmos, personalizing it, creating a ritual, and then having something kind of coming into being based upon the ritual that we're doing. And I mean, historically, there is astrology magic that is almost like the Shakespearean, in Hamlet, where the witch is stirring. I don't remember which it is, but it's like, you know, eye of Newton, two hairs of dog, and one of these and three of these. And at the moment of the full moon, you put it and you heat it to 170 degrees for 35 seconds. There are a lot of people who do rituals that are that exacting. And it is a way of approaching ritual. On the other hand, it seems like it takes very little energy to drive a resonant circuit. What do I mean by that? Well, as a kid, I built crystal radios, because when you were a boy and you're interested in science and there were no computers yet, that's what you did. And a crystal radio is kind of a cool thing. It's a battery with a wire that's attached to a tuning device, which is actually called the variable condenser, and you tune that and that changes the frequency. And then in that, there's also a little quartz crystal, and the quartz is a very interesting mineral, because quartz has what is called the piezoelectric effect, which means when you put pressure on it, it gives off electricity. Those people who are into crystals and using crystals in ritual, and some people might go, oh, that's a bunch of baloney. Well, it used to be that you could not make a radio without having a quartz crystal in it. Go figure. That's why they were called crystal radios. And in fact, one could argue that even today, with our sophisticated computers that are buzzing at, you know, 10, 20 trillion times a second and complex, that even those, we couldn't have a computer without gallium or silicon, or these are basically minerals. They are crystals. They're tiny crystals. So back to my crystal radio. The thing is that when you're tuning that, when you get close to the radio station, it begins to come in. And it might be a little staticky, but you can hear it. And then you kind of fine tune it, and some really good quality crystal radios would have a tuner, and then they would have a separate knob that was a fine tuner. That's back to the Virgo. And of course, this is or was a new moon in Virgo, because Virgo is about the exact precision of the exact right frequency or right action. But it turns out that it takes very little energy to drive a resonant circuit, which means that if you get close, it's going to vibrate. If anyone's ever yelled into a piano, and if you haven't, you need to go do it. Open up the piano, if it's an upright or grand, if you're lucky enough, and you open it up, and there are all the 88 strings, or more than that, because many of the notes have two or three or four strings for each note for resonance. And you open up, and this worked with a guitar also, and you go like this, ah, and then you expect quiet, but the piano is vibrating. You hear the piano basically vibrating, and the piano is vibrating because it is humming to the resonance of the note that you yelled into the piano. It takes very little energy to drive a resonant circuit. And so what that means is astrologically, when we look at aspects, an aspect is basically two notes in music that are in accord with one another, and that chord has a very particular frequency. So for example, if you have, let's say you have the moon in your chart trine Saturn. This new moon was very closely trine to Saturn. So in your birth chart, if you have the moon trine to Saturn and it's exactly 120 degrees, well, that's like a radio station that comes in so strongly that you could turn the damn radio off and it's still going to come through the radio. And we call that aspect an aspect with 0 degrees of orb. The orb is how many degrees it is off of being exact. And one of the great questions that astrologers discuss when they get together is, what orbs do you use and why? And you have a huge variation here, depending upon either to use Freudian terms, how anal or oral you are. But you also have huge variations depending upon what school of astrology you learned, because there are some schools of astrology that are using very, very tight, I would say anal tight, and I mean that in the Freudian psychosexual development sense, that you would use very, very tight orbs where, let's say, a moon trine Saturn would have to be within 2 or 3 degrees of orb, otherwise it doesn't count. And then there are other people who would say, well, no, because the moon is so receptive that 8 or 10 or even 12 degrees of that trine would work okay. And then there are astrologers who, from some of the ancient traditions, use a variation on aspects that would say, no, as long as the moon and Saturn are in the same element, that they're going to pick up on that trine, whether it's 120 degrees or whether it's 138 degrees. It's still going to pick up on the buzz because it's Virgo, Moon, Earth, Saturn, Capricorn, Earth. And so we have this wide variety of the aspect, whereas the aspect is exactly 120 degrees. That's why we say it's 120 degrees. It's a trine with a 3-degree orb, meaning it's inexact by 3 degrees. That's just astrology language. So when does the aspect become a non-aspect? And I remember a very well-known astrologer once who was asked in a class setting, what's the widest orb that you would ever use for a conjunction? And this astrologer said, after kind of thinking for a moment, he said, 360 degrees if I need it. Now, he meant that a bit tongue-in-cheek, but here's the thing, that if you do not have a moon trine Saturn in your chart, you can develop a practice, and you might even call that a spiritual practice, but we'll bring that word in later. You can develop a practice that attunes you to receiving that vibration, even if your system, your body, your natal chart didn't have it originally. This is the power of astrology. Astrology is not meant to limit us by being one of 12 signs or having this aspect or not having that aspect. It's meant to give us an understanding of what our natural starting point is, and then we can see the variety of experiences, and then we can develop practices to extend our perceptions into places where it didn't go before. You know, and there are some people who would say, well, I don't think it works that way. Well, if you look at the world that we live in, if we didn't extend our senses into realms where we couldn't perceive, we would know nothing about astronomy, nuclear physics, computer technology, printed circuit boards. These are all microscopically and or in other frequencies that are outside of our realm of existence, and yet they certainly have impact to us. So let's come full circle around to something that you said was, well, it's a new moon in Virgo today. And, you know, I think that it is technically past, but we can catch a wave. I use the surfer imagery, which I like just in talking about waves. And I miss right now bobbing in an ocean and being, you know, being on waves or under a wave, as the case may be at times. But, you know, if there is an optimum moment to catch a wave, if there's a good wave and it's really nicely formed, really all you need to do is to be in the right place at the right time, aimed in the right direction, and just give yourself a little nudge. Because if you're not moving at all, the wave will pass under you and you won't be able to ride it. But if you just give yourself enough of a nudge forward, that catches it, and then boom, you're off. But if you're late and you don't catch that, you can paddle like mad and catch it anyhow. And in fact, even if you start a little bit early, if you know what you're doing, you can get up enough momentum and ride the, you know, the wave lower to the bottom than higher to the crest. Astrology cycles are the same way. We become too anal. That word seems to be floating around, I guess, with a Virgo new moon. That should be a word, because for those of you who don't know, in the Freudian technology, there were different types of stages where we lock, that he called the psychosexual stages of development, and the anal stage, which was basically around early child, you know, around early toilet training, was the learning to hold the anal sphincter so that we didn't poop everywhere. It's a very simple concept, but that type of personality goes through life holding things in. Whereas the oral, which is an earlier stage, which is about the suckling at the breast, is basically yes, anytime, any place kind of a thing. And just in a broad swath, we know people who are on either ends of that spectrum. And so Virgo as a sign is a narrowing sign. Virgo is about, it's like a laser beam that is at a precise frequency, which is why the textbooks say that Virgos can be cool and aloof. They're not cool and aloof. It's just their laser beam is not aimed at you. Get over it. Virgos are hot. They're sizzling, but they're so hot and sizzling that their attention is narrowed, and they're very careful to only aim that beam, you know, where it is intended to be aimed. And I'd say we just got off track, but this is a Virgo new moon. And that's the lesson behind this particular, or one of the lessons behind this particular new moon. And it's perfect that we're having this discussion around this new moon, because this new moon is in Virgo at 25 degrees of Virgo, and it is very closely trine Saturn, which I used as an illustration earlier, because Saturn is at 25 degrees of Capricorn. 25 degrees of Virgo, 25 degrees of Capricorn, that's within 1 degree, or being in the same degree, as 120 degrees, which is 1/3 of a circle apart. That's a trine that is nailed. It's not exact, but the astrology word for when you have an aspect with two planets that are in the same degree, even if they're in different signs, the word is partile, P-A-R-T-I-L-E. So the way an astrologer could describe this particular new moon is that this is a Virgo new moon, partile, trine, Saturn in Capricorn. That would be the exact right language to use for it. Now, Virgo is very attentive to detail because that narrowing beam of the laser. You see, Virgo has something in common with Gemini. What they have in common is Mercury, because Mercury in the traditional astrology, or actually in modern astrology too, Mercury rules or is associated with two signs. As a morning star, it's associated with Gemini. As an evening star, it's associated with Virgo. And Mercury has, like many of the planets do, it has two very different ways of expressing. Mercury is about mental functioning. It's about thinking. In Gemini, Mercury will connect anything with anything. It's connect the dots. I've probably said here before, I say it whenever I get a chance, that Mercury in the Gemini phase of its being is like an information slot. It has no discrimination at all. And I'm not making a judgment here. I have a Gemini rising. It's like, if there's data out there, I want it. And in fact, whether it's useful, whether it's valid, whether it's true, doesn't even matter. I just want the information because I want to be able to put it into a framework and connect it to other things. Very different than Virgo. Virgo is the critical laser beam that says, there's information out there. I want to know whether it's valid, useful, or truthful. If it's not, I'm not interested. That's the primary difference between Mercury in those two signs. And it's interesting that Gemini is an air sign. It's intellectual, it's thinking, it's mental. Virgo is an earth sign. It's practical. And in a way, Virgo is the least earthy of the three earth signs, Taurus, Virgo, and Capricorn, because Virgo is analytical. It is mental. It is cerebral, but it's only mental and cerebral to figure out what's useful and practical. And here, this new moon is so damn powerful because it's trining Saturn in its own sign in Capricorn, which is the planet of stability, structure, karma, you get what you deserve. Virgo is about the habits that we develop to be effective and efficient. Saturn is you get what you deserve. So the lesson behind this new moon, or the first, the primary lesson, is that this is a time to plant the seeds of practicality, but they have to be narrowcast, not broadcast. Because broadcasting is Gemini. That's boom, let's just get it out there. With Virgo, you want to fine tune it as much as possible. Now, having said all that, if you didn't do a ritual at 4 a.m., the question is, did you miss your chance until the next Virgo new moon, which will be next September or next, late September, or late August or in early September, mid-September? Have you missed your chance, especially since the next Virgo new moon next year, Saturn won't be trying because Saturn will be moved on to Aquarius. And so this is a really rare opportunity. Did you miss it? And my emphatic answer is no, you did not. Now, there are astrologers, and I respect some of these astrologers who would disagree with me. But my experience, there's two issues here. So my answer is twofold. On one hand, the timing is more flexible than we think. In fact, another thing that I've probably said here before, and if I haven't, I will say it here again, and that is astrologers share something with three distinct groups of people that many astrologers would like to think they don't want to share with at all. And the three groups of people that astrologers share something very basic with are people who practice a fundamental religion. I mean, fundamentalists who are practicing and adhering to a religious doctrine, to modern scientific theory, science, and modern Western medicine. And the thing that they all have in common with astrology, with astrologers, is like those three groups of people, most astrologers think they know more than they do based upon what their study is. Now, let me be really careful here, because in some of those disciplines, and certainly in astrology, we do know more than we would have known had we not studied it. But then we jump and we think that we have an answer for every question. We think that we look at a chart and we can tell what to do or what not to do. We can read a chart, and into that we actually can find clarity. The universe is a lot more sloppy and complicated than even the analysis of astrology would assume or allows for. I'll give you an example. Mercury turns retrograde 3 times a year. The next time it turns retrograde is not this month, but next month in October, and it turns direct on election day in the United States. Now, you can look at most any software program, and it'll tell you Mercury turns retrograde at 3:41 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, or at 2:23, Western Australia Standard Time, or whatever it is. There's an exact moment when Mercury, which had been moving one way, begins to move the other. It's bullshit, because it doesn't happen in a moment. In fact, in a moment, at that moment, there's a moment where the planet isn't moving at all, because it has to change directions, it has to stop. But there's another complicating factor, and that is that we're on a globe spinning around, and that spinning around will put us on one side of the globe moving the same speed or in the same direction that Mercury was moving in, and on the other side, we're moving in the opposite direction. Because we're on this huge globe. So here we have this planet way out here that is coming to a stop, and it depends on which side of the globe we're on by a matter of perhaps minutes or more. And so we just have this sense of accuracy that the universe doesn't really have. Now, again, coming back to the Virgo full or new moon, which is past, I said there were two things. One of them was the implied accuracy, or the fact that rhythms are sloppier than we think, and that we typically work with a tighter margin of error. Oh, I mean, I teach a lot of astrologers, people who are already practicing astrology. In fact, I'm sure we'll get to the end. I'm doing the course for you on the fundamentals, foundations of astrology, which I'm just totally jazzed about. But even practicing astrologers who use computers, when they look at aspects, they'll have their aspects set up to be a filter. So let's say a square has to be within eight degrees of being a square. But if it's the sun and the moon, well, I'll be a little bit more open. We can allow 10 degrees because they're so bright and loud. Now that's fine, but what if you have two planets that are 11 degrees apart? If you're using a program, that program will sift that out. You won't even, oh no, that can't be a square. It's 11 degrees. It's too wide, you know? And so the first whole point on this is that our margin of error is actually our concluded margin of error is actually tighter than the universe can even be measured. So it's baloney. The second thing, though, is also very significant, and that is that any conjunction is a moment of unconsciousness. What do I mean by that? I mean that if two planets are in the same place or at the same point in their cycle, they can't see each other real well because there's no perspective. I sometimes ask students, if you know someone who is born at a new moon, try to get them to explain to you the difference between the sun and the moon. They can't do it because it's the same thing to them. They can mouth words, but they don't get it. Now, then you compare that to someone who has a sun-moon square or a sun-moon opposition, and man, they'll be able to go on forever about the difference, because in their life, they can see that the subjective and objective are not the same. And someone with a new moon will go, what do you mean it's not the same? How can that possibly be? All right, so if at a conjunction, it is like the void, it's like the beginning of the energy. The energy has no form yet. And in fact, most astrologers agree that the energy of a new moon takes a day or two to begin to get form. So it's almost like if you do a ritual prior to the moment of the new moon, you're really doing a ritual that's closing out the old energy and getting ready for the new. But you're not riding the wave. You're closing out the prior wave and maybe setting an intention and so on. But without a boost, I hate to use the vaccine concept, but without a booster vaccine, without a revisiting the original thought, it'll get pushed under this new wave. And so most people who do practical astrological or planetary magic will agree. And again, there are always people who have different perceptions on this, but most people will agree that if you're going to ritually catch the energy of a new moon, you want to really do the maximum ritual, 12 to 36 hours after the actual moment of the beginning of the cycle, because by then the wave has created some form and now you're riding a wave that has some substance. I think the real thing, though, with ritual, and this comes back to a Virgo concept, and this is aside from the fact that this is a Virgo new moon, but that is that rituals done once are probably of little value, or let me say less value than those that are done with great regularity. Now, the word regularity is interesting because the ritual of fasting for Lent is only done once a year. But if you're 60 or 70 years old and you've done this ritual every year, that is regularity, and that has developed personal meaning for you aside from whatever the first or two or three or four or five times you did it. Now, the same is true if you do new moon rituals for every new moon. You know, if you do them with great regularity, the ritual itself takes on its own form. Remember, Virgo is the natural sixth house or the sixth sign, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo. And that sixth house is the house of sometimes called work, service, or daily routine or habits. And it's because the attendance to something again and again and again actually ingrains the pattern. So if we're doing a ritual, whether we're doing a ritual at every new moon, that is one habit that we ingrain. But then there's another aspect to it, and that is that let's say we have certain intentions about this month that we're trying to bring to fruition, and we might create a little ritual to do around the new moon. Well, to just drop that and then not do anything again until the full moon is kind of foolhardy, because the Virgo concept says that the regularity, the repetition, the developing of the habit, it's like going to the pump and pumping water, nothing happens. You prime it by pouring some water down the pump, then you get water. Great. You don't use the pump for 2 weeks. You come back at the full moon and you go to pump it and you have to go through the same priming thing again. However, if you gave that pump a couple of pumps every half hour or hour, you wouldn't have to prime it because you're basically reinforcing the energy. So from that standpoint, the idea of ritual is simply that language itself doesn't do it. Language is very magical. Look, it's very powerful. It's architectonic. What we say actually becomes architectonic to how we live our lives and so on. It's very significant. But talk therapy has its limits. You're not going to talk your way out of stuff that is ingrained physically in your musculature, in your myofascia, in your body, in your heart, in your experience, in your world that you've created. You're not just going to by changing how you think, that's not going to change. Or it may change a little bit, but it's not really going to fundamentally change until you go through the ritual of actually saying, you know what I need to do? I need to make my bed every morning to just kind of get some closure on my sleep, because otherwise I don't seem to be able to wake up. I just totally made that up as an example. It's not, you know, something that one needs to or should or shouldn't do. But whatever it is, we need to bring these rituals into practice. Now we come to the word practice. Because an astrology is a body of information, and that's separate from an astrological practice, which in fact may dovetail, but it doesn't have to, with a spiritual practice. And we'll come back to that in just a moment. The thing, though, is that with any ritual, it's like going through the motions. I remember the wonderful Caroline Casey once said, and she's probably often said, she said, the gods don't speak English. And then she parenthetically says, they don't even speak Spanish. They speak action. We have to take the voice that we give, the list. It's part of why writing a list is different than saying it out loud, because saying it out loud is actually an action, but it's not a complete action. It's just the next step. Then we have to take something that we said out loud and actually do something. It may not be ultimately where we want to go with it, but we have to develop, we have to prime the pump. And does all that have to be done on the moment of the new moon? Absolutely not, because that energy of the new moon will build for 2 weeks until the full moon, at which time it then de-attenuates. But, you know, even the energy that's building at the full, at the new moon, and this new moon being late enough, being in Virgo, I mean, the fact of the matter is that as we speak now, the sun is still at the approximately the same degree, 25 degrees of Virgo, but the moon has already moved into Libra. Does that mean we've lost the chance to do this? No, because the seed in the void has been planted, but that moon going through Libra and Scorpio and Sagittarius is going to wear different masks, different flavors, but it's still going to be building the energy from that new moon. And now I take a breath. That was my opening sentence.
I'm glad you're taking a breath before we go to the next thing, because I think the summary of this is really cool. So there's basically three reasons why you don't have to do your ritual on a new moon or on a specific conjunction exactly at that time. If I got this right.
This is going to be good because I only thought I said two.
I know. You thought you said two, but I think you said three. Okay. It could be wrong. Okay. So number one is this idea of the resonant field and how it takes very little energy to drive a resonant circuit.
Yes.
That's number one. So there's a lot more wiggle room than we think, because that the energy in that circuit, we can catch that wave. I mean, I was thinking of my daughters who are just learning how to surf. They like to ride the white water. They like to ride the whitewash because it's easier on some days, you know? So yes, you can catch the wave at lots of different moments.
Right? By the way, that whitewash in my mind, because I spent a lot of time in the ocean, even though I don't live in Hawaii, the whitewash to me is the Aquarian energy. It's the high frequency that's not the wave, but it's way out in front of the wave. But Ooh. It contains a huge amount of energy. The actual crest of the wave is the Aries point, because that's the moment of now. But then there's the strength of the power of the movement of the wave itself. And it's this point that's just behind the crest, that's the Capricorn place, that if you can get on that, even though maybe not on a surfboard, that's the safest place than the place that's going to get to where it's going, because it's not quite as crazy or destabilizing. But yes, the froth in front of the wave to me is the Aquarian spot.
It will be so fun to map the whole wave cycle with the moon cycle too, which I'm sure, okay, we could probably do.
Anyhow, so that's one.
Yes, that's number one. Number two is that there's error in the way that we calculate the exactness.
Okay, sure.
Right?
Well, to me, that was part of the same thing, but you're absolutely
I like correct. It being two different things, because to me it's two different ideas.
Yeah, okay. I'm okay with that.
So the second thing is the error that we think it's at 4 o'clock PM or AM, but we don't actually have that perfect. Yeah,
let's call that margin of error.
Margin of error. There we go. The third is the moment of the exact conjunction between the sun and the moon is a moment of unconsciousness in which we can't really see. Like there's that void moment is what you're saying. And when we wait, there's even more momentum than that, like exact moment, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those are the three things.
The Tibetan Book of the Dead suggests that when we're at that, I called it the void moment. It would call it the first bardo, the state of mind that was where there was no subject-object differentiation. Think of the moon, the new moon, I mean, the sun and the moon being subject, the sun being object. And at that moment, there is no I and you, it just all is. Hmm. And the Tibetan Book of the Dead has an interesting teaching around that. The teaching is, don't disturb that. The longer that lasts, the better. Because that builds power into it until it begins fragmenting out a subject and object. And so in a way, by putting all of our ritual into that emptiness and then doing nothing afterwards, we've basically lost the power of the wave.
Hmm. Okay. Couple questions. Can we do a question? Okay. Number one, would you say the orb that a person would gravitate towards using might also have to do with how sensitized they are to energy and how sensitive they are to feeling the shifts or not feeling the shifts?
Short answer, yes. Longer answer is more interesting. Because not only are different people sensitized differently, but each person is sensitized to different rhythms at different times in their lives differently. Mm. And so I do know people who seem to go through life reacting to a transit days or weeks before it occurs. I hate to even use these words because of the connotations, but I call those people aspect trigger happy. They're ready to, you know, to detonate the event prior to the moment when the astrology says it should occur. Mm. And then there are the celestial slow learners who basically get the weight of the event days, weeks, months afterwards, or maybe even never. You know, not every aspect affects every person in the way the textbook says that it could, should, or would. And so from that standpoint, people are different. The second part of that is that you may be a lot more sensitive to Neptune, whereas someone else may be a whole lot more sensitive to Mars. I mean, just pick it. And so... there we have a huge difference in the sensitivity to the different planets based upon how the planets are aspected in our chart. And then also we have a different sensitivity. You might be more sensitive to Neptune during the 2 or 3 years when Neptune is aligned with your Pisces moon, because Neptune is in Pisces right now. That might be an antenna off to Neptune. Whereas another time in your life, or someone whose Neptune or whose moon is in Sagittarius, just as an example, which is square to Pisces. So Neptune in Pisces would be square their natal moon. They may be going through a period of time where that dreamy and imaginative stuff is not getting through. And in fact, they may even have a little bit of resistance toward it. So they may be more open to other things or get the stuff than as a form of denial. So the answer to your question is yes.
One add on before I go to the next question. Would you also say the more we practice, the longer we practice, we also become more sensitized to the nuances? Like if we were wine tasting or if we were doing, you know, let's do that. Yeah, let's do that. But you develop a palate, right? And then you can actually, so would you say the same thing with astrology? We get more sensitized and we can feel it.
And that's what an astrology practice is all about. It's not just about doing charts for other people. It's becoming more aware and more sensitive to what those planetary changes are. So you begin to notice them without having to even go to a textbook. I'll give you a quick example. Mm. I noticed that last week when Mars went retrograde, that Carl Bernstein who came out with the book, or was it Bob Woodward? It was Bob Woodward. Is that Woodward?
I think so. Yeah, that sounds
Bob familiar. Woodward, Carl Bernstein. Yeah, it was Bob Woodward. Came out with a book that was based upon interviews, that 19 interviews that he did with Donald Trump back in February, March, and April. But the book entitled Rage was released on the day that Mars went retrograde.
Amazing. Yeah.
Okay. Now, many other astrologers noted this also. And so I'm not claiming this as any, oh man, this is right. something I know. It's just something that if you have astrological sensitivity, you begin to notice things like this that reinforce your understanding of the rhythms. I'll give you another quick example. Earlier this week, there was something that hit the news like a, and it was everywhere. And that was the discovery of the potential of life on Venus.
Yes.
And the crazy and fascinating thing here is that the day or within 24 hours of the, I mean, again, the energy was there. The person had done the work, but the announcement that hit the media occurred while Venus was squaring the planet Uranus. And every astrologer knows that Uranus is the planet of sudden, unexpected breakthrough, you know, awareness. It's called Uranus the Awakener. It kind of shatters what we thought and brings some new information to us. And it was Venus that was squaring Uranus.
Wow. So, that's so
again,
cool.
I'm not using these as like breakthrough teachings or whatever. I'm just saying that as you begin to do your practice, you extend your awareness and you begin to notice these things on an absolute and regular and consistent basis. And that's part of what developing an astrology practice is, so that we are more attuned to the rhythms that would otherwise be invisible, because astrology as a study of correlation is correlating rhythms and frequencies that are normally beyond our normal five senses. But of course, we moderners know that the idea of five senses was simply based upon the superstition of materialism, that we have infinitely more senses than five senses. It's just those five ways are ways in which we perceive the material world. And so we have an astrological sense, which is basically how do you perceive rhythms that are very, very, very ultra, ultra, ultra low frequency? Because that's all the planets are, is very low. We can't see them. They're not within the hundreds of trillions of cycles a second that the color blue or green or red is. Instead of being hundreds of trillions of cycles a second, they're one cycle every 250 years or whatever. But there's still cycles, and we still can open our senses to seeing them, and therefore we can use them for navigation and or for planetary magic.
Okay, we're going to go to astrology as a spiritual practice more specifically, and one more question, because when you were talking about timing, it made me think of the idea of talismans and creating, like, bottling up energy at a specific moment and then using it later or using it for a specific thing. Do you think that's a real thing? And can we do things like that? And does it actually work?
Yes. And I think this actually kind of opens the door to another quick story that I have. An associate of mine, a very well-known and respected astrologer, who I'm going to leave his name out of this, is very much a student of solar returns. And this person is a Capricorn. And this person's birthday is early Capricorn, like the week before Christmas, but right in there. Isn't that when your birthday is, or is it later?
No, January 19th.
Okay. So you're a late Capricorn. You're actually an Aquarius wannabe. You're an almost Aquarius.
Totally.
So this particular person, as a brilliant student of astrology, began to look at solar returns. And a solar return is what we moderners call a birthday. You know, it's the time at which the Earth goes around the sun and comes back to the place where it was on the day that you were born. It's always within a day or so of the calendar day, but astrologically you can calculate the actual position and can construct a chart for the moment that Earth returns to the relative place as to where it was at the moment you were born every year. And there are many astrologers who use the solar return chart as a way of fine-tuning the year ahead. And in some ways, this comes back to what we were talking about, because we in the Western world all practice an astrological ritual without even knowing that it's astrological. And what is that ritual? It's the ritual of stating intentions at a new moon or at the beginning of any cycle, because every year on our birthday, the sun is lined up with where the sun was when we were born. And as anyone who does any form of ritual knows, that often at the beginning of ritual, you light a candle so that you can get the energy going, and then to release the energy, because that's when the magic happens, not when we hold on to it, that when you blow the candle out, that's when the energy is released. So what do? We make a wish and we blow out the candle.
Amazing. You can't
make this shit up.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
It's just an astrological ritual. But it's an important one because it begs another question. We talked about the timing. Okay, so you do that on your birthday. All right, I know people who are busy on their birthday. They have their birthday 2 days later or a party. Everyone gets together. They do the same thing. Does it mean it doesn't work?
No.
All right, but here's going back to my friend. This person put a lot of stock over the years into his solar returns because he could see in his life how they worked. Mm-hmm. And so every year coming up toward his birthday, October, November, he would draw up the solar return chart for his birthday. And then he would think about what he wanted to accomplish in the year ahead. And he would see where that chart changed in different places in the world. And every year for his birthday, he would go physically to a place in the world for his solar return chart for it to manifest, so that the solar return occurred in the third house or the eighth house, or that this square occurred here or not there. And it was very calculated, which of course Capricorns do, because they like to better the odds in their favor, so that they often take as much information as they can and they make a plan based upon their calculations. So this guy basically every year would get on a plane and go somewhere. In fact, one year, many years ago, 20 some odd years ago, he called me up and said, "Hey, what are you doing the week before Christmas?" I said, "Nothing." He goes, "Well, I'd like to come and visit for a few days because I need to be in Seattle for my solar return." And he did. And I began to think about this. And the question became, is getting on a plane and going somewhere required to make the solar return work in the way that you want it to? Or is it the intention that he would put in and the visualization, and that in a way the going there was simply the ritual that solidified it? It was like that priming of the pump. Mm-hmm. And instead of going to Greece, could he have had souvlaki for dinner?
Right.
Might that have been enough? You see how this is the exact same question from a slightly different perspective?
Yes.
And I think here that the significant thing has to do with a combining of intention, visualization, and then action. And without the action part of it, whether it's actually getting on a plane, you know, and going to Denmark or India or Seattle, if there are other ways to accomplish that.
Well, and so it could, so if as far as talismans go, he could essentially have made something, even if he couldn't, let's say he couldn't go on his birthday that year, he could have made something to represent the moment of his solar return and then taken that with him on the trip later, potentially. And I know, and what you're saying too is the thing that's amazing about what he was doing is he was putting so much energy behind the intention that it almost has to manifest when you're putting that much like momentum and energy and intention and focus in that direction.
Yeah.
So I think it was probably helpful, but did it have to be? There's probably other ways to do it.
And that is the question. the real question actually about talisman in general, and I have to say that one of my favorite astrological characters throughout history is a man who I've perhaps mentioned his name here before. This would be a good deep dive some week just because his story is so incredibly rich. And that man's name is Marsilio Ficino.
Yeah.
And Marsilio Ficino was the court astrologer to three generations of Medici's in 15th century Florence, and was perhaps the architect of what we call the Florentine Renaissance. And he was an ordained priest who practiced astrology and wrote a book on talismans.
Mm.
Now, how do you meld all, the Pope was not happy with this boy at all, just to be perfectly clear. But talismans are not only something that's made at a particular time. It's also made with a particular intention, with particular ingredients.
Mm.
So it doesn't have to be at a moment in time, although I have a dear friend who has built a business basically making what she calls intention beads. And they're handmade beads that she makes a run she makes, you know, 20 or 30 things at a certain particular configuration. And with the intention of that chart, supplies them to people who buy them with the chart and a description of the energy, and those are in effect talisman, talisman, talismans, whatever.
I've been wondering that this whole time. Every time I say talisman or talisman. Anyways, I'd love to hear what you guys think.
Talismans.
talismans. Yeah.
So the idea of bottling time, I think, is very interesting, and it's a metaphor that I've played with over the years, and I think that Jim Croce's song "Time in a Bottle," you know, is an interesting metaphor for how we sometimes take a moment in time and actually encapsulate it in one way or another. I know herbalists that pick a certain herb at the dark of the moon or at the full moon. I know people who make certain things based upon certain times, certain essences. But it's not just the timing, it's also the intention, and it's also the ingredients. And I think that all of these things are ways in which we can capture a moment. A man who I've spoken about here, I know before, one of my favorite authors, a guy named Lyle Watson, who passed several years ago. Lyle Watson, one of his just magical books is called The Secret Life of Inanimate Objects.
Mm.
And it addresses this issue of how things that are not animate can hold and contain energy, consciousness, and intention.
Mm. Wow. I mean, I'm even thinking of how looking at a picture of something can transport you into a time, or a certain smell puts you right back in your mom's kitchen. And I mean, it's like things are bottled up in different ways. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Rick, about an hour in, is astrology a spiritual practice?
Oh, the answer to that is to me very easy. Only if you make it so.
There you go.
That astrology in itself is not a spiritual practice.
Right.
There's nothing spiritual about astrology. I think I said last week that Ram Dass used to say there's nothing spiritual about the Ten Commandments. However, if you follow the Ten Commandments and then stumble onto a spiritual path, you'll probably be better equipped than the person who has broken six or eight of those commandments to follow that path.
Yeah.
Astrology in itself is not a spiritual path. However, if you stumble onto a spiritual path and either already have an inkling of astrology or begin to study astrology, astrology is like it's like metaphysical steroids.
Yeah.
It will basically, increase your journey in infinite directions with infinite depth. But I do know astrologers who are economists, who are stock market or Wall Street commodities traders, And I know some of them who are spiritual, but I know some of them who really just don't have an interest in that. To them, astrology is mechanics. And by the same token, I'm sure that you could find physicists that were mechanics, perhaps like Stephen Hawking was, and physicists who are totally on a spiritual path, perhaps like Fred Alan Wolf, or it comes to mind, and there are many, many others. But I think that if you're on a spiritual path, disciplines like physics or music, there are musicians who are just mechanics and who are brilliant at the mechanics that they do. And then there are musicians who have such a spiritually rich and wide life that their music is contained in their spirituality. And Peter Cater comes to mind. I think we'd mentioned him once before, but you know,
He has a house on Maui, and he does, I went to a real small concert with him.
And so, I mean, Peter Cater has been, I think, my favorite solo pianist for, I'm going to guess, 40 years. I mean, but he is a lifelong practitioner of Vedanta, of meditation, of and his music is an extension of his spirituality. Now, that compared, and I can't think of someone else on the other side of the spectrum, but there are musicians who simply are mechanics and do what they do very well. By the same token, that's true with astrology. Now, having said that, I think it's difficult, although I have known a few people, I think it's difficult to be an atheist and an astrologer, because it's just so awe-inspiring to see this intelligence of the universe as it unfolds. I think it was Albert Einstein who said something like, you know, you can go through life and either think nothing is a miracle or everything is a miracle. And the thing about astrology is that if your mind is open to it and if you're on that path, what it does is it takes all the things that are mundane that happen in your immediate sphere of things, and it extends it outward to as far as the senses can perceive. Is astrology a spiritual practice? No, but a spiritual practice that encompasses astrology is very useful, and you find astrology interwoven with many of the great spiritual practices on the planet. Even if the religion that spiritual practice came up in does not necessarily utilize or promote the use of astrology. You know, yes, it's the difference again between a practice, a spiritual practice. I mean, one can practice shooting ducks. Now, for someone, although I got to say I'm not sure how, that could be a spiritual practice, you know. But for many people, it probably isn't. It's just, this is either whether it's for food or sport or whatever, it's something that is done. And yet, I think it's difficult to really devote time and energy to astrology without it being a spiritual practice. But I do want to say one other thing before we leave this topic, and that is... that a spiritual practice doesn't solve anything necessarily. It might help us along the path. It might widen our perspective. It might give us additional choices in a situation. But I am not of the belief that all is good and that changing your mind changes everything. All can be good, and changing your mind can change everything, but just because it worked for you, it's a huge mistake to assume that it will work for everyone. You know, this is the same thing as the, you know, the person who says, you know, I had Rolfing, it changed my life, everyone should be Rolfed. I found Jesus, it changed my life, everyone should find Jesus. I did this, I did Dianetics, I became a Scientologist, everyone should do that. We have to be careful about generalizing something that's worked for you and or you and a bunch of people that have done the same thing and it's worked for, because there are situations, there are people where that's just not going to be the same thing. And in fact, you saying that can be incredibly disempowering, because what happens is that person then finds Jesus or does Rolfing, and their life doesn't automatically change. And now they go, there must be something wrong with me. I must be in much worse case, you know, than anyone ever thought. I must not be doing it right. I'm a failure, because what you've done in that situation by saying all you need to do is do this and everything will be great. You know, I get it that people say that because they want to instill the confidence in people who are going to be doing that practice. And yes, so much of our world is determined by our mind. But I come back to another one of my favorite Ram Dass lines, you know, and that is that, you know, God comes to the hungry in the form of food, and you're not going to have a spiritual awakening until you get the 500-pound rock off your foot. So if you have a 500-pound rock on your foot, changing your mind isn't necessarily going to make the pain of that rock on your foot go away. So now we come back to, is astrology a spiritual practice? Yes, but all is not good. Okay, I understand that from a standpoint of pure mechanics, Buddhist philosophy, we are all sensibilia. We are all kind of impulses of subatomic particles. There is nothing different between you and me and some distant star. We are all just energy flowing through us. But as soon as I impose my consciousness and my self-awareness, it alters the game. And as long as I am incarnate, as long as I am in a body, I'm going to have to deal with that game on one level or another, and to just go into denial about it is not necessarily the solution. So there's my 2 cents or 3 cents on that subject.
It's really interesting, your perspective. And I definitely understand what you're saying, because there's, if you just go, oh, we'll just change your thoughts and everything's going to shift and it'll happen immediately, I can see how that would be disempowering. But I was also thinking about the guy with the rock on the foot. And if the guy with the rock on the foot is thinking, oh my God, this hurts, and I can't get it off, it's not going to shift, right? If the guy with the rock on the foot is, someone could come and take it off anyways. It could, you're right. That is not absolute.
It could. And at the same token, that person could do all of the mind games and all the things and find relief moments here and moments there. Uh-huh. But uh-huh. Ultimately, 2 weeks or 2 decades later, with the rock on his foot, he's now saying, you know what? This sucks. That whole practice sucks. This doesn't work for me. I'm a failure. My life is a failure. This is not okay. So yes, I'm not saying that there's no mental practice to do. There is. But it in itself, unless it's understood in a wider context, can be dangerous. That's all I'm saying. And it gets the whole wellness industry. All you need to do is change your diet. All you need to do is this. You won't get this. I don't know how many, I don't know what it is that I bought when, but I get 5, 10, 20 emails a day, you know, saying that if I, take Quercumin, my joint pain will be gone. If I take, Echinacea, I'll be 3 inches taller. It just isn't mechanical, and it isn't that simple. That's enough there.
It's so true. Okay. All right. So here we go with the summary for this part. Is astrology a spiritual path? The answer is only if you want it to be. And if you want it to be, it can be like metaphysics on steroids.
Okay.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
And it was so good. I was like, we need to make a meme out of that. That's so good.
Yeah. And actually, I would say it rather than metaphysics on steroids, I would say it's like metaphysical steroids.
Metaphysical steroids. There you go.
Slightly different languaging. But yeah, your point is correct. And yes, I did say something very close to that. So
okay, good. All right. And yes, so for me, one of the biggest benefits of astrology, it's especially when I first started studying it, was that it gave organization to my spiritual practice. So it was, it first of all, the timing gave the rhythmic, you know, moon cycle timing, even the birthday timing. And then I loved, I've always said, it's like the universe is shining a spotlight on different areas of life that are highlighted for us at different times. So instead of like reading every Ram Dass book or reading every spiritual text and trying to apply it all at the same time, you actually get to like organize it a little bit and be like, okay, this part of my life, I'm working on these themes and this is what's up for me. And this is where I can put my focus. If we're talking Virgo, this is where I can like shine my laser. And that alone is so helpful in the spiritual practice. And what I've experienced is that there's a deepening. The more we're going into astrology, the longer we study, the like more
like any practice.
Totally.
You practice sitar 10 hours a day for 20 years, your practice is going to deepen and widen to more than just the scales that you've been playing on the sitar. Exactly. By the way, there's one other thing I want to say about this new moon, just because that's where we really started. Yeah. And although this new moon is trine to Saturn, very, very significant, it was also exactly, and even closer than the trine to Saturn, it was forming a sesquisquare, which is a square and a half a square. Sesqui is like a sesquicentennial, is 150 years, it's one and a half. A sesquisquare to Uranus. And this is a bit of agitation as to how much is enough and the difficulty of the exact line that we're making into all of it. It's like it's like a disruptor, it's annoying, it's irritating. And then you add into this mix the fact that Mercury at the new moon was also making a partile, close to exact, square to Jupiter. Jupiter is the expansive planet. Mercury is the mind. And so when at a square where there's conflict, it's like we can become overconfident. We can take on too much. Virgo wants to narrow it. Saturn wants to make it real. Uranus is kind of this temptation to take it all down or to bring it all up rather than just the one thing. And then you add in that Mercury square Jupiter and all of a sudden it's like, well, if I do this, I can do that and I can do this. And why don't I just, and all of a sudden it's become so big that we lose the Virgo in focus. So this new moon, whether or not you've already done your ritual or whether you're modifying it or whether you're just bringing it into being now in whatever way that you do, it's important to be sure that you don't take on more than you need to. This is about setting priorities, and this is about narrow. Again, I think I used at the very beginning the concept of narrow casting rather than broadcasting. It's narrow focus, not broad focus.
Mm. Awesome. Yeah, our inner circle guide this month is Stormy Grace, and she was saying the same thing. It's like those little steps we need to take in order to get to the big vision, but really focused on those day to day, inch by inch type of focus. Really good. Yeah. Thank you. That was so much fun as always. Loved it. Thank you so much. And thanks to all of you for tuning in, and we can't wait to connect with you in the chat. Please check out Rick's class. I gotcha.
You're half a step ahead of me.
I could read your like lean forward, like, Amanda, don't forget. Go to astrologyhub.com/foundations to check out.
Foundations.
Well, actually, both of them will get them there. So it's okay. It's foundation or foundations. Yes. But go on over there and check out Rick's course. It's starting on October 4th. It is going to be a very Saturnian building block type of class that will help you build the foundation that you need for your astrological practice. If you're new, even if you don't want to, my parents want to take it. They're never going to be astrologers. I mean, but it's anybody that wants the knowledge of the building blocks, like how it all comes together, how we define certain things. So, and if you're practicing, if you're already an astrologer, this will be a great opportunity for you to learn from Rick and his approach and his perspective and the way that he does things. which I know you all love to do. It's like your continuing education credits, right?
It never ends. I love listening to other astrologers talk about things that I think I already know. And then I realize, well, I never thought of it that way.
You know? Yes. So. Yeah. So it's coming with like, what are you calling them? Study resources, study guide?
Study sheets. Yeah. Something.
Study sheets. Yeah. So it, Rick has put together these gorgeous presentations along with study guides and sheets and supplements and things that will go with your studies. Starts October 4th.
It's and then there'll be a live Q&A every week.
Yes, every Friday. So you'll get your module on Sunday, starting October 4th, for 5 weeks. You get your module on Sunday, and then on Friday, there's the live Q&A session with Rick. We'll be collecting questions all week, and he'll be answering as many questions as possible every Friday. This is taking place over the course of 5 weeks.
And if you can't make or miss the Q&A, if you're on the other side of the planet and it's at 4 in the morning, it's recorded and yes, you'll be able to watch it at your leisure.
Yes, and you
you'll
still
be able to watch all of it at your leisure, whenever you choose, even after the course is over.
Absolutely. And you'll still have a chance of getting your question answered because we're going to be collecting questions beforehand. So you don't have to be there live in order to get your question answered. So it's really exciting. Rick hasn't taught a foundational level astrology course in decades, and he's doing it now. And we're just so grateful and humble that he has chosen Astrology Hub to do this with. So thank you, Rick. This is
and thank you. And thank you all for making this fun and a success. And I'll see you here next week.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Take care. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being a part of our community. It's astrologyhub.com/foundations. And thank you, as always, for making astrology a part of your life. We'll catch you on the next episode.